Good morning. My name is Max Schultz. I'm the director of the Center for Energy Policy and the Environment at the Manhattan Institute. On behalf of our president, Larry Moen, the Smith Family Foundation, and the International Policy Network, I want to welcome all of you here this morning. I'm particularly pleased to be able to introduce our guest this morning because he's someone whose work I admire very much. Bjørn Lomborg is an adjunct professor at the Copenhagen Business School, which is where he first gained international attention with the publication of his book, The Skeptical Environmentalist. That book was born out of an interview that he had read with the late Julian Simon. Simon had said that by almost any measure, the environment is getting better. And Professor Lomborg, who at the time was, I think, an ardent supporter of Greenpeace and possessed of, I think, fairly conventional environmental sensibilities, that claim rankled. And so he asked his students to investigate these claims as a class project and with the aim of debunking Simon's mad claims. And over the course of their research and looking into the truth of these matters, they found to their surprise that Simon was largely correct. So Professor Lomborg committed a real act of apostasy. He reported his findings, and he echoed Simon's claims that the environment, by and large, is getting better. And he did this in op-eds and articles, which were laden with citations and footnotes. He wrote a book to this effect in his native Denmark, and a version of that later was published internationally. It's the book we know, The Skeptical Environmentalist. Challenging the prevailing orthodoxy is not an easy thing to do. It requires honesty and integrity, and ironically, these are precisely the qualities that Professor Lomborg found himself accused of lacking once he published his book. Since the publication of The Skeptical Environmentalist, he's been subject to a withering attack on his character and on his scholarly credentials, and his motives have been impugned. All because he showed himself to be a fairly honest broker when it comes to issues where hyperbole and hypocrisy are too often the common currency. With his latest book, he again challenges the conventional wisdom. And in this instance, that conventional wisdom is coalescing around the issue of global warming. You know, it's an area where we see Nobel Prizes and Oscars given out to those who would, frankly, stifle debate and stifle inquiry. You know, people who suggest that anyone who raises even a point of contention is no different from someone who denies the Holocaust. I think that, by and large, the public discounts these arguments in large part because those who often make them are so often exposed for hypocrisy of flying in private jets and living in overly lit mansions. And it's easy to laugh when Ted Turner says, as he did last week, that global warming is going to lead us very soon to cannibalism. But for all the absurdity of claims like this and the absurdity of those who are raising alarms, there can't be any doubt that climate change is a concern of many Americans. Just how seriously we should take the challenge of global warming, and you know, is it, as many suggest, the single most pressing issue facing humanity? These are precisely the questions that Professor Lomborg addresses in his book, Cool It, for sale over here. I hope that you would buy it. Professor Lomborg says that global warming is indeed happening, that mankind shoulders some of the responsibility. That's hardly denying the Holocaust. But he puts the issue in a perspective that has been sorely lacking. Importantly, he pits the long-term challenge of battling climate change against more immediate problems like global poverty and AIDS. And in the process, he provides a very rational way of thinking about a topic which is too often subject to irrational and strident terms. That's why we invited him to New York this morning. That's why I'm very pleased to introduce him, and I would ask that you give a very warm welcome to Professor Bjørn Lomborg. Thank you. So. And we will pepper him with questions when his talk is over, so think what you might want to ask him.
Brilliant. Thank you very much, Max. and it's a pleasure being here. Max kind of gave the whole story away, so you already know what I'm going to be saying, but I'll say it a little more detail. I'll talk for about 20 minutes, so we'll have plenty of time for questions afterwards. My main point really is to have a conversation about... This is not where we're supposed to start. I mean, we can do that, but that's not really... Sorry. My main point here really is to have a conversation about what should we do on global warming. This, of course, has become the discussion that we virtually almost have around Al Gore. You also alluded to him. This is from the presentation that Gore and I did at Congress last year. This must be the second just before he realizes who I am, because he's still smiling. But of course, the point is that both Al Gore and I, and I believe most people, are actively engaged in having a conversation about how should we think about these issues? How should we actually move in order to get to actually tackling global warming? I'm just going to make four very simple points. I think in order for us to get a sense of how we should proceed on this issue in public, we really need to be able to whittle down. The UN Climate Panel publishes every 5 or 6 years about 2,400 pages, which are, again, summaries of thousands and thousands of scientific papers. In one way, this is a very, very complicated debate. In another way, I think it's a fairly simple debate. And I'd like to say, let's try and simplify, not out of order, but to get a common understanding of what is actually the crux of this conversation. So I'm simply going to make four points. I'll try to document them. We can have a conversation about them afterwards. The first one is global warming is real and it's man-made. I think we need to say this is just simply obvious. This really is happening. This is really something that we need to take serious. And I think we should also, and I know some of you might actually feel uncomfortable about that, but I think we should say thanks to Al Gore for putting this on the agenda, to making clear this is a problem. Global warming, by virtually any scientist, again, I'm a social scientist, so I simply accept the natural science that comes out of, for instance, the UN Climate Panel, the so-called IPCC. This is by no means a perfect organization, but it is the best we have. It's the best information that we have right now in climate change, and virtually all climatologists are telling us, all other things equal, if you put it more carbon dioxide, it's going to get warmer. This does not mean that there's not a lot of other opportunities for both to influencing it and also causing changes in climate. But all other things equal, we will probably help change that climate. The likely temperature rise that we expect to see by 2100, by the UN estimates, is about 2.6 degrees centigrade or about 4.6 degrees Fahrenheit, which is not a trivial amount of temperature rise. As you can also see, the global economic models estimate that the total cost of a standard sort of scenario of global warming, the medium scenario of global warming, is not a trivial amount. It's about $15 trillion. That's certainly an amount that ought to make us sit up straight in our chairs and think about how can we best deal with this problem. On the other hand, and this is the kind of point that I constantly try to get to, is to say we need to put these things in perspective. We need to get a sense of proportion. The net worth of the 21st century is about $3,000 trillion, so we're talking about half a percentage point of the 21st century. And I think that gives it very well. By the end of the century, we're not going to look back on the century and say, wow, this was the century that was dominated by global warming. It was a problem throughout the 21st century. It's a problem we need to fix, but we also need to fix it smartly. And my argument is simply it's unlikely we're going to make good choices if we're scared witless. In a sense, if somebody puts a gun to your head, you're unlikely to think rationally. And we need to, because at the end of the day, we can't spend the money twice. We have to prioritize well the first time around. And I mean, you all know, if somebody comes up and put a gun to your head and say, give me your money, you don't stand around and think about alternative uses of your money, right? It's not like, oh, would I rather buy a toaster? So you just hand over the money. And so that's the point. We need to get a smarter strategy. But yes, global warming is real, it's man-made. On the other hand, and that's my second point, it's often vastly exaggerated, it's one-sided, and that is unlikely to make for good judgment. And unfortunately, this is where we have slightly less thanks to give to Al Gore. Again, I'm not harping on about Al Gore because so many people are saying this. Al Gore is just the most visible person making this argument. And Al Gore clearly, you know, talks about global warming as the planetary emergency. This is one of his quotes from the website for his movie, where he says, "We have just 10 years to avert a major catastrophe that could send our entire planet into a tailspin of epic destruction involving extreme weather, floods, drought, epidemics, and killer heat waves beyond anything we have ever experienced." I think this really very well resonates with what we typically hear in the press. You know, this is Al Gore, but we hear it virtually several times a week. And I would simply like to take you through at least some of these instances and show you how this is misleading and one-sided. It's not incorrect. Actually, you'll find that probably everything here, it might be a little over the top, but it's actually all true. But the problem is, by not telling the other side, by only focusing on one side and forgetting to give a sense of perspective, I would argue we're not being very well informed on this debate. I'll just go through three of these issues. Of course, there are many more in the book. Heat death, sea level rise, and malaria. It also covers both the developed and developing world concerns. Take a look at heat death. Are we going to see more heat death because of temperature rise? Absolutely. As temperatures go up, there's going to be more heat waves, and that means there's going to be more people dying from heat waves. This is absolutely true. In the UK, it's estimated these are the best studies that we have, mostly from Europe, for heat and cold deaths. And they estimate that by 2050, on average, you're going to see about 2,000 more heat deaths every year in Britain because of global warming. That's definitely serious. It's something we ought to recognize and say this is a definite problem. I mean, it is also something that's very, very often underscored by many of the people who are arguing this point. The curious point, however, is to say, surely, as temperatures rise, yes, it's going to mean more heat waves, it's going to mean more heat deaths, but of course it will also mean we're going to see fewer cold waves and therefore also fewer cold deaths. Now, of course, if this was a trivial amount of people, maybe it wouldn't be worth pointing out, but it's not. In the UK, again, it's estimated that by 2050, because of fewer cold deaths, fewer cold waves, we're likely to see about 20,000 fewer cold deaths. Now, I would argue, saying correctly, that there's going to be 2,000 more heat deaths every year in Britain because of global warming, but failing to say that there's going to be 20,000 fewer cold deaths because of global warming is not actually leading us to have a good sense of how we should deal with this problem. And of course, again, and a lot of people do this, I was introduced on the Colbert Show by a guy who says that global warming could be good. He's from, no surprise, Denmark. And you could imagine that, obviously, you know, If you're from Denmark or in Britain, maybe global warming would be good. But it actually turns out that this is true virtually everywhere in the world. It's actually, our only global estimate is that we are likely to see about 400,000 more heat deaths, but about 1.8 million fewer cold deaths. So if this was the only problem with global warming, we should actually have more of it. That's not the point that I'm making. Because, yes, there's both going to be positives and negatives with global warming, but we have to be truthful and tell both sides. Now, overall, there are more problems than good things. That's why it's a problem. That's why we need to fix it. But we need to get realistic about this. And only telling us the negative sides, only telling us stories where global warming is good for bad things and bad for good things, is simply a way of telling a fairy tale. It's not a way of informing us well. So I would argue we need to get all the facts on the table. So when Al Gore's telling us, yes, there's going to be more heat death, it's true, but it's, I would argue, very misleading. Likewise with sea level rise, if you look, for instance, on sea levels, they will rise. Water, just like everything else, when it gets warmer, expands. That's why we're likely to see about a foot of sea level rise over the next 100 years. The UN estimates somewhere between 18 and 59 centimeters, about half to 2 feet. The most likely outcome is about 1 foot. But it's not Al Gore's 20 feet. Now, Al Gore shows, you probably, even if you haven't seen his movie, you've probably seen this clip because it's one of the most shown clips from his movie where, you know, Florida, it gets deluged by 20 feet of sea level rise, and then New York disappears, and San Francisco disappears, and Holland disappears, and Dakar disappears, and Shanghai, it's a very long movie, and Beijing disappears. And I understand why he made those slides, because it looks really impressive. But if it's not the real number, are we giving people a good sense of information? If it actually is 1 foot, what is the relevance of showing us 20 feet? I understand why he didn't show the 1 foot, because obviously you wouldn't have been able to see it. But it's not a very good argument for not showing. So yes, sea level rise is going to be a problem, but it's not going to be the end of the world as it's very often depicted. Actually, we know how damaging 1 foot of sea level rise is, because over the last 150 years, sea levels rose about 1 foot. Yet did anyone notice? Imagine asking a very old person who've lived through most of the 20th century, it's likely to be a woman, and ask her, what were the important things that happened in the 20th century? She'll talk about the world wars, the suffrage for women, maybe the IT revolution, but she will not say, oh, and sea levels rose, right? And that underscores the point of saying, this is a problem, but it's a problem that we have fixed, and a problem that we can very easily fix. It doesn't mean that we shouldn't be concerned about it, but it means we need to get, again, a sense of proportion. The last point I just want to mention, and again, I'm rushing a little bit through this because it's also important to get to our questions, but a lot of people will tell you, but we're going to see more malaria with global warming. And yes, it's true, malaria is weakly correlated to temperature. So as temperatures go up, we're probably likely to see about 3.2% more malaria by the end of the century. So if we, for instance, do the Kyoto Protocol, we can avoid about 0.2% malaria by the end of the century. The question that I just simply focuses on is, isn't it strange that we care so much about thinking about those 0.2% malaria that's caused by weak correlation to temperature? Because obviously, there's a much stronger correlation to wealth. If you're rich, you don't get malaria. Even if you get malaria, you don't die from malaria. If you're poor, you get malaria and you die from malaria. So my point is simply, isn't it curious that we worry so much about doing something about 0.2% malaria in 100 years when there's 100% malaria right now that we could fix so much cheaper? Let me just give you a sense of proportion. If we all did the Kyoto Protocol, including the US, including Australia, including Canada, Spain, Japan, all the other countries that are actually living up to their requirements, and did so for the rest of the century, with reasonable estimates, we could save about 1,400 people from dying from malaria every year throughout the century. Now, I certainly want to be part of a civilization that does that. But I'm just curious about why it is we don't actually think about, if we really care about malaria-stricken people, we could save 850,000 lives every year throughout the century for 1/60th of the cost. Or to put it differently, for every time climate change measures would save one person from dying from malaria, the same amount of money spent on malaria policies could save 35,000 people. The question really is, why is it we seem so intent on saving one instead of 35,000? So my point here is simply to say, yes, when we say there's going to be more malaria, it's probably true, but it's focusing on the wrong point, because if we really cared about malaria, we could do so much more. Yes, sea levels are going to rise, but not by 20 feet, by 1 foot. And quite frankly, that is not a big challenge. And yes, we are going to see more heat deaths, but we're actually going to see many more people not dying from cold. We need to know. So while it's technically true what we're being told, I would argue that it leads to a dramatic imbalance in the way that we actually understand the problem, of course, then in the way that we deal with the problem. So that's my third point. Yes, global warming is real. It's often vastly exaggerated on one side, leading to bad judgment. And that's why we need smarter options. Right now, we're not doing very well. Virtually everyone is talking about we should do the Kyoto Protocol or do more than the Kyoto Protocol. We're actually meeting next year by December 2009 in Copenhagen to do the follow-up to the Kyoto Protocol. And surprisingly, people are just saying, well, let's do more than the Kyoto Protocol. But let's just take a look at what the Kyoto Protocol could do. Even if everybody had done what they promised, including the US and Australia, but also everybody who actually signed up, did what they signed up to do, like Canada and Japan. If everybody had done that, the Kyoto Protocol would have postponed global warming by the end of the century by 7 days. And the cost would be $180 billion a year. That's a lot of money for very, very little good. Even if we extended the Kyoto Protocol all the way through the century, it would still only postpone global warming by 5 years at the end of the century. So instead of having the black temperature curve, we'd have the slightly lower red one. So the temperature that we would have seen in 2095 now would have been extended to 2100. This is entirely uncontroversial. Everyone knows this. You can have a discussion about is it 6 or 8 days, and if we extend it, is it 5 or 6 years? But the point is, this is uncontroversial, that what we're talking about is spending lots and lots of money doing virtually no good. My question is simply, should we perhaps start thinking about finding a better, smarter strategy? Before I just get to that, I'd like to leave you with one image which I really think summarizes much of this. I also opened my book with this argument. The plight of the polar bears. Polar bears in many ways have become the icon of global warming. And I think it's ironic in the way that it's actually being used. Because people, first of all, think that the polar bears are threatened right now, which of course is not true. If anything, we've seen a dramatic increase, probably a quadrupling or more of global polar bear populations from about 5,000 in the 1960s to about 22,000 now. But this does not mean that global warming will not mean that polar bears will have a harder time with disappearing and eventually, with diminishing and eventually disappearing summer Arctic ice. We are likely to see polar bears under stress and probably fewer polar bears. But the question again is then, is the right way to help polar bears, is that really to do the Kyoto Protocol? Most people seem to think so, but nobody actually talks about how much good that would do. Let me just give you a sense of proportion. If we make reasonable estimates on what that would actually mean, it means that if everybody did the Kyoto Protocol throughout the century, we would probably save about one polar bear every year. Now, I'm all for saving a polar bear a year, even if it costs a couple of $100 billion, but I'm just curious about, isn't that strange that in this conversation, nobody seems to talk about the very, very simple fact that right now, we shoot somewhere between 300 and 500 polar bears every year. I don't know about you, but my sense is maybe we should stop shooting 300 polar bears first at very, very low cost before we worry about spending billions and hundreds of billions of dollars on saving one. And the idea here is really to say there's something wrong with this conversation when every question you have only can be answered in one way, namely cut carbon emissions. Now, surely sometimes that's the right answer, but surely it's not always the right answer. And that's the point here. Surely the best way to help the polar bears was not to cut carbon emissions, but to stop shooting them. And maybe we should have the same conversation with all the other issues that we're dealing with. Right now, the problem with global warming is that the cost of cutting CO2 is about $20 per ton or more, depending on what level you set. Yet the benefit of cutting is about $2 per ton, the benefit you do to the world, which is why it's just not a very good idea to do very much right now. Now, most environmentalists would then respond to saying, well, maybe we should talk this up. But you can't really change reality. I mean, if this is the damage, then this is the damage. What we could do, however, is to try to focus on bringing this cost down. What if we could make it dramatically cheaper cutting carbon emissions? That, I would argue, is the real only way that we can get people to move forward. And that's why I'm suggesting the only real smart way forward is to make sure that we have much greater investment in research and development non-carbon emitting energy technologies. I specifically suggest that for the Copenhagen consensus, for the Copenhagen meeting in 2009, we should say, we all pledge to spend 0.05% of GDP on research and development and demonstration of non-carbon emitting energy technologies. The point is, it'd be about 10 times cheaper than the Kyoto Protocol, yet it would mean a tenfold increase in what we're spending on research and development right now. The point is, we don't know what the right solutions are, so we would suggest that countries should do their own decisions. You know, should it be renewables, fission, fusion, conservation, carbon storage, second generation biofuels? There are lots of different opportunities. But the point is that preliminary studies show that this would actually fix climate change in the medium term. And let me give you a metaphor for why this is the case. Right now, solar panels cost, say, 10 times as much as fossil fuels, which basically means only a few rich people in the rich world will have solar panels on their rooftops, mainly, of course, to look good. And virtually nobody in the poor world will have solar panels to produce electricity. Now, the point and the solution to global warming is not to pressure a few more of these very inefficient solar panels on people, because, first of all, it's incredibly expensive and that's really going to do anything. What would be a solution, of course, is if we could focus and force research and development. Somebody didn't listen. If we could force research and development so that we would actually be able to have much cheaper solar panels. Imagine if we, through these kinds of programs, could make solar panels cheaper than fossil fuels by 2060. Global warming would be solved. Discussion would be over. People would switch to solar panels, not because they're good people, but because we had made it so that it was cheaper for them. Now, of course, I don't know if it's going to be solar. I don't think anyone knows. But the point is, if we invest a lot in all these different issues, we don't know which ones are going to work, which ones are going to work. But they don't all need to work. We just need a few of them, and those are the ones that will power the rest of the 21st century. But really, we will only get a lot of buy-in from the rich world if it's much cheaper. And honestly, we will only get buy-in from all the poor countries of the world, China and India and Brazil and all the others, if we make it dramatically cheaper to deal with climate change. So my point is, yes, global warming is real. It's often vastly exaggerated, which basically leads to really, really poor decisions, as we're seeing right now with biofuels and many other issues. That's why we need smarter solutions. We need to focus on how do we actually make better solutions, much cheaper solutions, available for the future. Now, I could stop here, but let me just do one more thing. The fourth point is something that is very close to my heart, is to remember that there are many other problems that are much more important to fix first in this world. And I'll just speak very briefly about it. Al Gore talks about global warming as our generational mission. This is how we want to be remembered. We should have a conversation about how do we want to be remembered by future generations. And I think that's absolutely true. How do you want to be remembered by future generations? I'm always very, very surprised that Al Gore and most other people seem to want to be remembered for spending hundreds of billions of dollars doing virtually no good 100 years from now. I'm not really sure my kids and grandkids are going to say, great going there, Dad. Yeah. The point, of course, is we have to ask ourselves, are there other and better things that we could do? And just to give you a sense of proportion, the UN estimates that for about $75 billion a year, we could solve all major basic problems in the world today. We could give clean drinking water, sanitation, basic health care, and education to every single human being on the planet. My question is simply, very, very, very simply, how would you rather want to be remembered? Spending twice as much money doing virtually no good 100 years from now, or spending half that amount and fixing all major problems today? When you put it that way, it's not really a hard question. And of course, we could even put in the $25 billion that needed to fix global warming in the medium term. The point here still is we need to get smart about this. And that's what I'm working together with some of the world's top economists in something called the Copenhagen Consensus, where we bring together five Nobel laureates. We're actually going to do this again in a couple of months in Copenhagen to look at all the world's problems, all the world's best solutions, and say, where do you get the most bang for the buck? This was what they came out with the last time, the first global priority list for the world, saying the very best thing you can do in the world is prevent HIV/AIDS. Not treat, but prevent HIV/AIDS, especially, of course, in sub-Saharan Africa. Then prevent micronutrient malnutrition, ensure free trade, and prevent malaria. They actually went so far as to say, how much good does every dollar we spend do in these areas? And what they showed us was, if you spend a dollar on preventing HIV/AIDS, basically buying condoms and information, you do $40 worth of social good in the world. That's a great investment. Likewise, $30 for micronutrients, $15 for free trade. That's basically paying off French farmers. $10 will prevent for every dollar you spend on preventing malaria. At the other end of this list, they also told us, was Kyoto. Not that it wouldn't do some good. It actually would. But for every dollar you spend, you'd do 30 cents worth of good, which is why they call it a bad investment. It's not to say that global warming is not real. It's not to say that Kyoto doesn't do some good. It's just to say it doesn't do very much good. And that's why we need to scale back and start thinking about how can we fix this in the best possible way. So yes, global warming is real. It's often vastly exaggerated. We need smarter solutions. Let's focus on research and development, get better technologies for the future. And please, let's also remember that if we actually want to make a difference, if we want to be remembered well by our kids and grandkids, there are many other issues we really also need to fix. Thank you.
That was great. Thank you, Professor Lomborg. We're going to open it up for questions and would ask that when you are called, if you would stand and introduce yourself. Right here. Yes.
Jerry Orstrom with the Epicurus Fund. Thanks very much, Bjorn. I'd like a little further explanation on the notion that human-induced global warming is real, as you said. I'm not a cynic about that, but I remain, I like to think, a scientific skeptic. I think it's a viable and important hypothesis, but given the complexities of climate, the fact that we have no underpinning theory of climate, the fact that there are many drivers of climate which we haven't even identified, much less been able to measure those that have been identified. I think it's a real violation of the Copernican principle to be so arrogant as to say that we know what level of impact we are having on climate. So could you address it from that perspective, please?
Yes. And again, also remembering, I'm a social scientist. Obviously, I've read a lot of this, but I'm basically going to be saying stuff other people have said. And so the idea is simply, we know that there's about 200 watts coming in per square meter on this planet. We know from simple theoretical physical models, if you put in about twice as much carbon content in the atmosphere, CO2 content, you will have an increase in the retained energy input of about 4 watts. So you have about 200 watts coming in. What will happen is it'll go up a little bit by 4 watts. That's fairly uncontroversial. What you're saying is, but isn't there a lot of other uncertainties? Isn't there a lot of other things driving this? Undoubtedly. But the point is, I would say, is that we realize that this is an issue. Now, as I see it, sure, we're never sure about anything. We will never know for sure what our models are telling us. But I would argue in general that we'd be well advised to say, this is what the smartest people on the planet are telling us right now. This doesn't mean it's true, but it means that... Well, no. I'd say if you look at the climate scientists, you know, they've tried hard. Obviously, they have not modeled everything. You know, you can look to clouds, water vapor in some senses, and there's a lot of other more long-term things that we have very little understanding of. But then again, we don't live in millions of years. We live in the next decades or hundreds of years. And in that sense, sure, there's likely to be variations. But what we're doing is we're adding on to some of these variations. And we do know, we do have a sense of how much we're adding on. And if we're adding on, you know, four or five degrees Fahrenheit to that temperature, that seems like a reasonable conversation to have. I think the argument is much stronger to say, yes, that's happening. It's not, we have to remember it's only one of many things. But all other things equal, things are probably going to be warmer by the end of the century if we keep emitting carbon dioxide than if we didn't. And so we should have a conversation about whether that pays off. Let me just leave you with this final thought, though. I think we should, first of all, fund people who try to find out differently, because we certainly want to know if there are other and more important drivers, like, for instance, the sun. Again, this is an unproven hypothesis as of now, but I would argue if it is important, we should certainly know. You know, because that would be dramatically important for our spending decisions. But moreover, just remember, if it actually is such that we later on find out that maybe it's going to cool in general because the sun is entering a new cold era or whatever, then that's not where we are now. That's not what our understanding is now. But what that points out to us is that we are actually doing something that's fairly unsustainable in the sense that we're only worrying about one outcome. What will happen if things get warmer? And then trying to scale a little bit back. Of course, if it actually ends up getting colder or something else, then we'll probably be pretty bad off by trying to have made it a little more cold than it would otherwise have been. And what that underscores is maybe it's a more robust strategy in general, to focus on making people rich, to make societies robust, rather than just focusing on dealing with one variable, which, of course, is one of the points I try to do, for instance, for malaria, but also with all the other areas, to say, if what you want is to have better societies, and I would argue that that's obviously what we want. Nobody cares in principle about CO2 content or even temperature. What we care about is its impacts on people and the environment. And if there are other and better ways to make sure that people in the environment is well off, maybe we should think of those first. And I think that's where we can see the impact.
Right over there. Yes.
First of all, as to who I am, it says here, William Bramwell, New York City. I think that means every once in a while I give modest amounts.
You need to hold the mic.
Oh, sorry. Yeah. Yeah, I think that means every once in a while I give modest amounts of cash to the Manhattan Institute. My question is a variation of yours, Sir Jerry Orstrom, and that is the matter of causation. One thing that seems to be missing in all these conversations is, well, all right, so number one, sir, you say you're a social scientist, not a science scientist. Okay, fine. So you're repeating things you've heard other people say. But when you say, if you add carbon, temperature's going to go up. Yeah, but what degree of causation can you attach from one to the other? One of your friends, Professor Robert Linson of MIT, says, correlation is not causation. College Logic 101.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, they're wonderful demonstrations of how storks, the populations of storks have gone down in most developed countries, and the number of children people get have gone down. But it doesn't mean that there's a good or at least that's what my mom told me. But the real point, of course, here is to say that a lot of people will then show, if you've seen the Gore movie again, he shows you how over the last 650,000 years, CO2 and temperatures has correlated incredibly well. But what he doesn't tell you is that the CO2 rise came after the temperature rise, typically some 800 years later. Which, of course, only goes to prove, yes, of course, back then, SUVs weren't driving the climate. You know, and he mainly shows that graph because it looks so good, and it makes people understand the idea, but it's an incorrect document. But it doesn't mean that CO2 can't also cause temperature rise. And as you just mentioned, Linson is a very skeptical guy, very well-esteemed scientist, but very skeptical of many of the conclusions. But he would also say, yes, all other things equal, if you put in more CO2, things get warmer. The discussion is, and I think that's the sensible discussion, is how much warmer, and the scientists have debated this for 25 years and quite frankly not gotten any closer to it, and also how do we then best tackle those problems, and that's a social science problem, and that's where I think we need to have this conversation. It's unproductive to have a conversation about does CO2 cause increased warming. I mean, it's a fairly simple physical point. Yes, it does. The question is how much. But much more, what should we do about it? And I think that's where the relevant debate really is to be had. And that's one that we all can participate in.
Mr. James.
Robert James, I'm a businessman here. You cited $75 billion from the UN to take care of water, education, health, and what there's a fourth.
And education? Sorry, water, sanitation, basic health care, and education. Yeah.
It would seem to me, should be looked at. There is no way, when you see what people spend for education and water and health.
Oh, I didn't say everybody would get a Harvard education. Right?
Well, $75 billion. I would really suggest you examine that figure. That per year?
Yep. Yes. Oh, yeah, yeah. It's per year.
Per year. But it seems incredibly that could take care of it.
There's a good point here, because obviously, the UN has looked at this in many, many different ways. I'm throwing it out there as a suggestion in the range. And obviously, you're not going to get water to the last guy who's sitting on a mountaintop somewhere. Right? We're not going to plumb that. Do you say that plumb? Put plumbing up there, and likewise, there's a lot of other things that obviously are, a little dodgy around the edge. But what it gives you is a sense of the proportion. But I'd much rather have you get a sense of the overall point. What it does is these kinds of estimates are typically estimates of what would it cost if everything could go as well as we like to hope it could. But obviously, things never do, and so no, we're not going to get everything out there. But remember, this is the exact same point as when you look at the cost of the Kyoto Protocol. When I say $180 billion, that's the cost if all politicians were as smart as they possibly could and as well coordinated globally over the next 100 years. Now, what are the chances that they're going to be that? Now, not very big, right? And I think the European Union is a good place to start. If you look at the European Union has having said, basically, U.S. is not going to save the planet, so it falls back on the EU to save the planet, which then says, it's going to cut its emissions 20% by 2020, which I think there's no other reason for it than it sounds really good. But the problem is they've not only then decided that we should cut carbon emissions by 20%, but also exactly how, namely through renewable energy. Now, that sounds nice, but of course, it's also one of the costliest ways to do that. So what they basically said is, let's do a bad deal, but let's make sure it costs 4, 5, or 6 times more than it had to cost, which of course is pretty stupid. But that's what politicians very often do, and not stupid in their perspective because they're supporting a lot of different causes, just like, by the way, George Bush and many others have supported ethanol. which have, you know, great policy opportunities to police big agro-business lobby. But it's just a very, very bad move in the sense that it simply means that more people are going to starve, you're going to cut down more rainforest, and, oh, you're probably going to emit more CO2 by the end of the day. So the point is we can make a lot of really, really bad policy decisions. And so I think yes, the UN estimate might be an optimistic estimate, but I was comparing it to another optimistic estimate. And the other point is to remember, there's something curious about this whole global warming debate where everybody will say, on the natural science side, things are probably going to be much worse than what we would imagine, which seems to me a little odd because, you know, if we have a range, you'd imagine the middle point is probably the most likely. But there's something curious going on then when they talk about the cost, where they always assume that the best of all worlds will happen. And it seems to me, if anything, we know much better than if it comes to policy decisions, certainly very, very costly, long-term, very highly complex issues, you're likely to see worst outcomes more likely than best outcomes there.
So that we can let everyone be productive and get to work today, we're just going to take one more question. Two questions.
Hello. Andrew Borncroft from Adaptable. What arguments do we have against liberals who say that just as for the last 30 years there was a growing consensus of scientists who said that this is man-made and real, who say that just as that was the case, today there's a growing consensus of scientists who say that abrupt climate change scenarios are quite possible and even likely, and that the climate might oscillate, you know, to another stable state, say 30 degrees away, and that's the real danger of climate change, not the 2.6 or 2 to 4 degree change, but an actual 30 degree sudden swing to a new ice age state or something unknown.
Yeah, and I think it's an intelligent response, and quite frankly, Thomas Schelling, one of our Nobel laureates, who looked at this for a very, very long time, he says, you know, it's not about the medium outcome, it really is about the catastrophic outcomes. Those could change our thinking about it. If things were to go really, really bad, and if we did the Kyoto Protocol, they wouldn't, then the Kyoto Protocol probably would be a good investment. What you have to remember is, though, that the Kyoto Protocol has virtually no opportunity of doing so because obviously it'll only change at the margin. And there's very little reason, unless we are incredibly sure of the science behind it, that we know that was the exact thing that was actually going to switch us from catastrophe to not catastrophe. So essentially then it turns into, you know, in economic speak, it turns into an estimated value problem, which is exactly the median or typically the average values that we are looking at. But moreover, and perhaps much more important, there's something fundamentally wrong about saying, all right, so I can't convince you with just the standard scenario. So let me scare the can I say shit out of you? But that's certainly what we do, right? That we really get scared the bejesus out of us, right? And then you know, we say, oh, okay, then we better give these causes all our money. First of all, do we really know that if it's something we don't quite understand, do we really know that cutting carbon emissions is then the way to fix it? If we don't understand it, how do we know that cutting carbon emissions is how we should fix it? But perhaps more importantly, this is also true for all the other problems in the world. Listen, if we don't fix HIV/AIDS in the world, how do we know that that's not going to lead to the third world war by the end of the century? I mean, I can make it, it's not a plausible scenario, but I could make a possible scenario. You're going to have collapse of most of sub-Saharan Africa. You're going to have terrorist nests the size of, you know, Afghanistan's eventually all over the world, you know, all over sub-Saharan Africa, throw in much more easily available nuclear fissile material, and certainly a lot more biological and gene manipulation technology. You have all the opportunities for something that could turn into a world war. Now, I'm not saying this is plausible, but all you have to do is to demonstrate plausibility. You can make up any scenario, as statisticians like to point out. There's a non-zero probability that redhead women will take over the world tomorrow. Yeah, it's not, and some might actually like that, but the point, of course, is it's not necessarily very rational to say just because there is a probability. a non-zero probability, then we should do it. So my main point is really to say we need to have a sense of the size, and we need to have a sense of, is it likely that a reasonable policy interventions actually going to change that risk? And I think we are very, very poorly able to say yes to either of those two. So right now it's just simply scaremongering, which you could do in all the different areas of the discussions of the world, not just in climate, but in HIV/AIDS or micronutrient malnutrition or whatever you want to come up with.
Hi, Robert Rosenkranz. I wanted to bring it back a little bit to economics. You threw out a number there of $15 trillion. Oh, sorry. I just wanted to bring it back to economics for the final question. There was a number in the presentation of $15 trillion of cost associated with global warming, which I assume is kind of a netting of benefits and
yes.
costs. I just wonder if you could very briefly give us some color on what are the main elements of cost, what are the main elements of benefits that went into that number?
Yes. It's basically, and we have to realize that there's a lot of uncertainty in each of the individual areas, but the main benefits really come from the northern countries, that is Canada, some parts of the U.S., Russia, Ukraine to a certain extent, are going to, and some parts of northern Europe are going to have better agriculture, for instance. But you are going to see a lot of losses of productivity in third world countries especially, and some of the drought-stricken areas like Australia, southeast U.S., some of the Mediterranean regions. Then you're having wetland loss, you're having the loss of human lives. We expect, yes, we're going to probably see more heat deaths, but fewer cold deaths. But then on the other hand, you're probably also going to see more malaria, you're going to see more of these other issues, more health problems because people are moving away from the place that they were used to, where their buildings were optimally adjusted. At the end of the day, this is and of course there's the adaptation costs, for instance, to rising sea levels, which are not tremendous by any standards, but probably about 0.1% of GDP, or a little less than that for most countries. So, it's an aggregate of all these different issues. They're typically based on expert questionnaires or on the individual studies, but then often, there's a limited range of areas that have been included. But then you have a vast literature where different people have included different things, and you sort of get an overall sense of what is probably the likely outcome of this. Again, just like it was stated back here before with the climate models, these are not perfect models, but again, it's the best ones that we have. And so I would argue any rational policy decision-making process should say, yeah, this is what the smartest economists, just like the smarter climate scientists are telling us, and that's how we need to deal with it first. But it doesn't mean it's true, it simply means it's the best we know right now.
Thank you, Professor Lomborg. I want to thank all of you for coming. Sorry that we weren't able to get everyone's questions. You might be able to snare them on the way out if you have something you'd like to ask them. Again, thank you very, very much.